Flutist Ransom Wilson has been a soloist on the international scene since his 1976 debut performance with Jean-Pierre Rampal. He has performed with some of the world's leading orchestras and soloists, including Chicago Symphony, Philadelphia Orchestra, San Francisco Symphony Orchestra, BBC Orchestras, and soloists Frederica Fronstada, Jesse Norman, Thomas Hampson, Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg, Jean-Pierre Rampal, and Sir James Galway, and many others. For decades, Ransom Wilson has also been pursuing a conducting career, leading Solisti New York, an orchestra he founded in 1981, London Symphony Orchestra, St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, Denver Symphony, and mostly Mozart Festival, also the New Jersey Symphony, and other orchestras. And he's been conductor with the Metropolitan Opera and New York City Opera. He has also worked with the Glimmerglass, Minnesota, and Portland opera companies. Starting with the 2016-17 season, Ransom Wilson was named music director of the Redlands Symphony Orchestra in California. He still maintains a busy performance schedule and is a professor of music at Yale University.
I'm still recording. I mean, I don't do, you know, as many recitals and concertos as I used to, but in performance, but I'm still... I just recorded with one of the BBC orchestras. It's actually not out yet, but I'm still doing that. So, keeping very busy.
Yeah, what's the literature on what pieces?
It's a French 20th century concertos, Hubert Rivier, Damas, and Francais.
Ah, okay. Because I know you have varying tastes, including, I think, newer music, too, don't you, as far as...
I do, yeah.
Yeah, I'm curious. You got into conducting some years ago, because
it's actually been about 30 years since I started, and it was a slow period of acceptance on the part of the business, especially since I wasn't willing to stop playing. But I feel like I really do know what I'm doing now after a long period of learning, and you never really, I mean, what attracted me to it in the first place was just the unlimited repertoire, because the flute repertoire is limited, and I was, you know, I had pretty much played the greatest music written for my instrument already, and I was always eager for new pieces, but that didn't really satisfy me completely. And, you know, I love Brahms and Tchaikovsky and Schumann and Stravinsky and, you know, on and on and on, you know, John Adams. I kind of like a little of everything. So that's really the main reason I got into conducting in the first place. And I studied it very seriously. I had great teachers, and I have a very clear conducting technique. And, you know, whenever anybody compliments me on that, I always refer to my teachers, because that's the only reason I have any technique at all, is my teachers.
Yeah. As time goes on, whether as an instrumentalist, a player of some instrument, or as a conductor, you develop your own ideas and interpretation, and I imagine that is some appeal to getting into conducting too, isn't it?
Well, yes, I mean, because... you know, when you're confronted with a masterpiece, you have to figure out, you know, it's like somebody places a mountain right in your path, and you've got to figure out how to climb it. In terms of, you know, interpreting music, I was, because I'm, you know, still teaching a lot, I often use this analogy of, you know, someone takes you to the David in Florence and says, okay, you have to decide where to put the spotlights. Like, what of this masterpiece are you going to bring out? And that's kind of how I feel. Like what, instead of just letting it play itself, you know, what am I going to show the listener? And that's a never ending challenge.
Yeah. And I imagine, those sorts of things, despite where you're at any particular time, the kinds of things you may realize need to come out in a particular piece may change, probably does change.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I had the great good fortune of studying with Leonard Bernstein, and I met him on. He invited me to be his soloist on a long tour with the Israel Philharmonic, two long tours, in fact, where he went around the world, and so I got to see, you know, I got to know him and know how his mind worked, and you know, number one, certainly the greatest genius I've ever been privileged to know. I remember when. You know, he traveled kind of with an entourage of assistants and this and that, publisher people, and whenever we in the entourage couldn't sleep, we would be up, you know, watching TV or whatever. But Lenny would be writing poetry in Hebrew, you know. So it was just, you know, at that point in his life, he was near 70, so you know, he wasn't the wild young kid that he had once been. But I mean, the reason I'm talking about this is because I knowing his recordings over the years, they changed in many ways. They became much more structural, and by the end, his tempi were so slow that it was actually sometimes difficult for the players. But they always made musical sense. That was the thing. He was actually going for a particular thing. He didn't want it to be flashy. He wanted it to be profound. And so I think that just comes with age.
Yeah. And you can take recordings by someone like Leonard Bernstein in his earlier years and then compare it side by side with a recording done later on in life, regardless of the orchestra, and hear obvious differences in the things that he's done.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, he really was he was an intellectual, and a lot of people certainly early on didn't realize that because he was so he had so much energy about him, and kind of a wildness on the podium that no one had ever seen before, and I think so. His lifelong quest was to let people know that he really was a profound thinker and not just, you know, not just razzle dazzle. So whenever I would talk to him about music, the first things he would talk about were the hidden. The hidden structures that, you know, had taken him years to discover. I mean, I remember one thing in particular, because on one of these tours, one of the programs had Brahms' First Symphony on it. And since I was, you know, I was playing his flute piece called Khalil.
Yeah.
It was always first on the program. And then I'd be free for the evening. So, he let me sit in the orchestra and watch him conduct, which must have been great for him, you know, in retrospect. But I was sitting back by the trombones, who don't play until the last movement of Brahms' First, so nobody noticed me, I'm sure. And Lenny did something in the slow movement at the end of the, there's that kind of motto phrase that keeps coming back. And he would do, he did something with the timing of it that I, you know, I asked him about, and it was that kind of question that would really get him going. He called it the Talmudic approach, you know, basically if you don't ask questions, you don't get answers. And, at least that was how he summed it up to me.
Wonderful.
And, yeah. And he said, and I was asking about, why do you take time here? And it was the question he was waiting for, you know, and suddenly I got a 45 minute enlightenment of that one phrase. So he really was an intellectual, certainly by the end, which is why I knew him. And I do feel that happening to me too. It's certainly never on that level, but I do feel those changes.
Yeah. It's interesting. And you ate up that wisdom that he shared with you. And you only wish that at 13 when you're studying for your bar mitzvah or studying, listening to the elders of your family or something, sharing some sort of wisdom that you were able to absorb it and understand it like you do later on in life.
Yes, well, you know, as they say, youth is wasted on the young.
yeah, ever learning the meaning of that statement.
yeah.
Who were, I know Jean-Pierre Rampal, and I had read that Leonard Bernstein was one of the main people in your life. Who were some of the other people that inspired you in some way?
Rampal was certainly number one, I would say about him, I think I learned more from him about how to be a generous person than I did about flute, and I learned a great deal about flute from him. But his magic went far beyond his playing. I mean, his playing was brilliant, of course, but he had a kind of human generosity that I had never encountered in my life before. He went, you know, he immediately recognized something in me that was also in himself. And so he gave me special attention when I went to his classes over in Nice in the early 70s. And by the end of knowing him for a couple of years, I had a Fulbright to study with him in Paris. He said, you know, we should make a recording together. I had been researching these double concertos, two flutes and orchestra, at the Bibliothèque Nationale, and I found three of them. And he said, well, this is enough for recording. Why don't we make a recording? And I was like, sure, okay. You know, being young and stupid enough not to realize what an extraordinary gift this man was giving me. But he was very, very philosophical about those things. He never wanted to have credit for his generosity. But I saw him over the years do extraordinary things for people he didn't even know. And so he still is my role model, and I still miss him every day. And you asked me about other people. Montserrat Caballé actually was one of my big influences. I was studying flute at the North Carolina School of the Arts. I was, you know, 15 or 16. And my teacher was trying to get me to you know, kind of learn how to support using my abdominal muscles. And it was going to change everything about my playing. And I was very distrustful of such a big change. And he said, look, if you don't believe me, you need to come and hear the local orchestra play tonight, because there's an extraordinary singer from Spain. This was like 1966 or 67, when Caballé was just beginning to be known in this country. And I went, and it changed my life, because I realized that it was possible to do extraordinary things with your instrument, in her case, her voice, without tension. And she just would stand there without moving and float these pianissimo high Cs in a way that just I found thrilling, and actually quite profound for my own playing. It's like I immediately understood what I needed to do.
Yeah.
And I did end up actually meeting her. We had the same. By the time I had an EMI Angel contract, and so did she. So through the record company, I got in touch with her and asked if I could have a lesson with her on breath support, you know, using your body. And she said yes, and Opera News got wind of it, and they sent a reporter to write. And the guy they sent ended up being Bernstein's librettist on A Quiet Place. Stephen Wadsworth, but he wrote this article about this lesson that I had with Caballé, and God, it must have been 1980 or something. And we were, she and I were supposed to do an album together, and I had arranged all of these songs that were in her repertoire. I added a flute part to them and orchestrated them for a small group, and we were all set to do it. We were going to record it in San Francisco, and she canceled. She was kind of, she canceled a lot, you know, for health reasons, and it upset. She'd canceled so many times, I guess, it upset the EMI people, and they just canceled the whole project. So we never got a chance to do it. I still have those arrangements downstairs. But yeah, she was a big influence on me, although I only really met her that once.
Yeah. And but you learn and should learn at some point as a, especially a wind player, how much, and that's why you hear it all the time, how much, how important breathing is and relaxation, and how equating how you're playing to singing, how important that
is. Yeah, absolutely. And she, well, and, you know, and so that when I started conducting, I ended up being invited to be an assistant conductor at the Met, which I did for 10 years, pretty recently. It ended about 3 years ago. And I learned even more at that point because, you know, even as an assistant, I had to go to every single rehearsal, and I got to work with some of the greatest singers in the world. The first time I did Vesti la Giubba from Pagliacci was with Roberto Alagna in a rehearsal. I was terrified. I can imagine one of the most famous tenors in the entire world doing perhaps the most famous of all tenor arias, and it's my first time, you know. It's kind of scary.
No kidding. how did you relax into it? Just getting started? Just diving in?
Well, you know, in that situation, when you're with a famous singer that's got the way they do it, what you're basically trying to do is accommodate their interpretation. So it wasn't quite like working with a young singer, in which I would have kind of imposed myself more in the situation.
Isn't
I feel like I was kind of along for a very exciting ride.
Yeah. Isn't that the sort of similar to the situation that maybe a young student will face when they first come to you as their teacher, and they can't let themselves go to interpret. And they're trying to just emulate something you're saying, and so you, and I guess what you're described earlier is that you try to get them to let that go and decide for themselves what ought to come out in the music.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean I love teaching, and I'm extremely lucky. The bulk of what I do is at the very end of young adults' schooling. So at Yale, I only have 6 students. They're all graduate students. And so for most of them, this is the end of their schooling. And they're at the point in their lives when they have to decide what kind of person they are, what kind of career they want to have, you know, where is music going to figure in their lives, and I find all those things exciting. And it also at that point, everyone, you know, when they get to Yale, they can already play at a very high level. It's a very competitive game, so they mostly don't need remedial work. Occasionally somebody will have had a bad habit just linger on, but it's pretty much they're at a professional level already in terms of their playing.
Yeah.
But often what has happened is that they have kind of psychological issues that keep them from being their best in one area or another. And I find that fascinating because that's how I did my own learning. was kind of overcoming barriers and phobias and predisposed mindsets and that kind of thing. And so I can help them with that a lot. And for me, that's really fun. And the results are often dramatic when someone actually lets go of their fear about a certain thing.
Yeah, that's those are
their flying blossoms in a way you couldn't have predicted even.
Yeah, the same with your I suppose your the revelations that you had as far as breathing and relaxation with Montserrat Caballé and breathing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, a lot of it, a lot of it was psychological, it's kind of psychological conditioning. Often it's cultural. Americans tend to think one way as a society, ignoring the fact that there's actually another way of thinking.
This is
very much in all of our thoughts right now, obviously.
Yeah.
And I think with that in mind, I'm always encouraging people to learn foreign languages because it forces you to think in a new way and see the world in a completely different way than you'd expect it. And I think a lot of what made Caballé great when she was young was the fact that she was Spanish. She was able to think about music and her voice in a very particular way that was, very different from how I had been brought up, and different from how a German would be brought up and that kind of thing. And I love those differences. I think they're wonderful, and I think they're essential for increasing your knowledge of the world.